Aid workers begin searching for bodies at Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital following the Israeli carnage at the medical facility. A number of Google employees quit their job over a contract with Israel, which they believe assists the regime in its onslaught on Gaza. Hi, everybody. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Palestinians witnessing an endless spiral of death and destruction in Gaza, where a U.S.-Israeli genocide is in its seventh month now. Israeli aircraft and artillery fire continued in different parts of the Strip, targeting homes and gatherings of displaced people. Dozens of Palestinians were killed in the latest strikes. The mayor of Al-Maghazi and several others lost their lives when the regime hit central Gaza. Now, in the southern city of Rafah, that was attacked once again, 84 bodies have been recovered from under the rubble in Khan Yunis since the Israeli occupation forces left the city on Sunday. Palestinian medical sources say that the regime has also significantly damaged the city's hospital and equipment. Since the beginning of the onslaught on October 7th, more than 33,300 people have been killed in Gaza. Aid workers have begun searching for the bodies from the rubble of Al-Shifa Hospital after 2 weeks of Israeli attacks on the medical complex. According to relief teams associated with the World Health Organization, the hospital was reduced to ashes by air raids and shelling. At least 400 bodies have been discovered so far. Many patients died inside the complex as a result of the Israeli siege. IOF soldiers pulled out of Gaza's largest hospital on Monday. They laid a siege to the building and staged attacks under the pretext that Hamas fighters were operating there. The resistance movement has repeatedly denied having any of its fighters inside Al-Shifa or other health facilities. Now, some aid workers speak about a lack of equipment to pile through the rubble of Al-Shifa Hospital, and some others recount the horrors that they've experienced at a medical complex.
Once the Israeli army entered within a minute or two, they surrounded the entire area. And after that, they started using the loudspeaker to say, "This is the IDF. The entire area is surrounded and everyone must surrender." Then they started shooting at all the entrances, preventing anyone from moving. I spent 4 days there with my two little daughters, without any food or water. They cried from the hunger, and when they arrested my husband, he had not eaten for 3 days.
The relatives wish to ascertain the fate of their sons, whether they have been killed or missing or have been displaced to the south. The relatives are present to identify their sons and ensure they receive a proper burial. However, we lack the necessary equipment for this task, and time is not on our side. We must complete the job before the bodies decompose.
There are challenges in the Gaza Strip. You don't have forensic doctors or organizations that document the crimes of the Israeli occupation forces. We try to utilize the expertise of the World Health Organization and the UN Humanitarian Office in documenting the crime which occurred inside the Al-Shifa medical complex. The stench of death is everywhere. We try with the help of the delegation of the UN Humanitarian Office and the delegation of the World Health Organization to dig the mass graves in Al-Shifa complex and to identify the decomposed bodies and the body parts that were crushed by the Israeli occupation forces. We try to identify these bodies and document these crimes which were committed against these civilians.
Our correspondent Muti Abu Musabbeh joined us from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Bala earlier with details regarding the situation in Gaza, including the southern city of Khan Yunis, where IOF soldiers left several days ago.
Given that the destruction there is massive, we can say that roughly 80% of the residential buildings and facilities were completely or partially destroyed. This reflects that there is hundreds of the Palestinian civilians are still trapped and missing under the rubble of those destroyed houses. And this means that the number of the Palestinian civilians who were killed over that attack will be massive. And as you know, that the the civil defense crews, they are searching for those dead bodies, and they are trying to extract those dead bodies, having their basic tools, and they are using their bare hands in order to extract those dead bodies. So this actually complicates the process, and this complicates the extraction of those dead bodies. We can see that what happened in Khan Yunis is unprecedented in terms of the massive destruction and mass slaughter of the people there. And even when it comes to Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip, the destruction that was inflicted in those areas by the Israeli occupation forces is nothing compared to what happened and took place in Khan Yunis City. What happened in Khan Yunis City is horrific, because as you know, that everything was breached by the Israeli occupation forces was targeted and destroyed. This included actually the residential buildings, the infrastructure, the pipelines, and everything. Everything was targeted and destroyed by the Israeli occupation forces.
A number of Google employees have quit their job over the company's cloud contract with Israel. The resignations reportedly came in protest against Project Nimbus. That's a $1.2 billion contract with Israel, jointly held with Amazon, to provide AI and cloud computing services. The protest group called No Tech for Apartheid says more than 1,000 Amazon and Google employees backed their efforts to stop the contract with Israel. Now, last week, a member of the group interrupted a conference promoting the Israeli tech industry and condemned Google's support for Tel Aviv.
I'm a Google Cloud software engineer, and I refuse to build technology that powers genocide, apartheid, or surveillance. Project Nimbus puts Palestinian community members in danger. I refuse to build technology that's going to be used for cloud apartheid. No cloud for apartheid. No tech for apartheid. Free Palestine.
Hatchfield was fired after his protest during a conference. Project Nimbus reportedly involves Google establishing a secure instance of Google Cloud in the occupied territories. It would allow the regime to perform large-scale data analysis, AI training, database hosting, and other forms of powerful computing. Recent reports in the Israeli media indicating that airstrikes are being carried out with the support of AI targeting systems. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says that a proposal made in the latest round of the Gaza ceasefire talks does not meet the Palestinians' demands. The movement says that there was no change in the Israeli stance during the Cairo talks. Now, we've discussed that issue in our news review program.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the proposal reached during the latest round of Gaza ceasefire talks does not meet the movement's and the Palestinians' demands. Hamas says Israel's position in the negotiations held in Egypt remains stubborn. The movement, however, said that it is still studying the proposal and will inform mediators of its response once it is completely reviewed. Hamas did not set any time frame for its response. The movement says that it wants a comprehensive ceasefire that would see the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza and the return of Gazans to their homes. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is a main topic as well. The Cairo talks were attended by delegations from Israel, Hamas, Qatar, and the United States. Muslim Qabsai is a Palestinian scientist and author who joins us from Bethlehem. We also have Booker Ngessa, member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement, who joins us from Nairobi. Welcome to you both. Muslim Qabsai, let me first start with you. Let's have your take on Israel's behavior here when it comes to these talks. First of all, they were prompted by the assassination of those charity workers from the World Kitchen Charity. Brought them out. Israel sent a delegation. And then you have supposedly these talks somewhat in motion, and then you have Israel come out now and say, we're going to attack Rafah, setting a time and date. It doesn't sound like Israel is very serious when it comes to these talks.
They intend to continue the genocide. That's their whole intention. And the Israeli government doesn't really care about its own citizens that are held by Hamas, including high-ranking Israeli military officers. This has been clear all along. It's a question of increasing pressure on Israel now. After 6 months have passed, what are they going to do? Are they going to let the rest of these people die as they continue bombing the areas of Gaza into basically flattening all of Gaza? Or are they going to really make some sort of a deal? My own estimation is that there will be some sort of a deal. It will not be ideal for us as Palestinians, because it will try to save Israel and get Israel from, basically get it out of the mayhem of the trap that they put themselves into Gaza. And that's, to try and get something by political negotiations they didn't get by force.
Booker, why do you think so many are saying that if Israel was to agree to a ceasefire agreement, that would mark a huge defeat for Israel, in particular for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu?
First, it's important to realize that the Israel state under the leadership of Netanyahu is not going for negotiation on a point of strength. In fact, they have been forced by their failures in the battlefield to now resort to negotiation on a diplomatic way to cover their failures in the battlefield. It's important that the Zionist leadership has continuously said that the Hamas is a terrorist outfit. Why will they be on the table with the people they consider to be terrorists? It is indeed because of Netanyahu's failure in leadership within the occupied territory, where there is pressure for the hostages to be released.
Thank you very much for that. Let me thank Massim Hopsai, a Palestinian scientist and author, and also Booker Ngessa, a member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review.
The International Court of Justice, holding its second day of hearings over Nicaragua's case against Germany for abetting acts of genocide in Gaza. On the first day, held Monday, the Nicaraguan delegation said that Germany is facilitating the genocide in Gaza by sending arms to Israel. It slammed the European country for suspending its funding of the UN agency UNRWA too. Now, on the second day of the hearings, Germany's legal counsel reacted to the allegations by calling them baseless and demanded the court dismiss Nicaragua's request for provisional measures. Nicaragua hoping that a case, if won, would suspend Germany's military assistance to the Israeli regime. The court will likely take weeks to deliver its decision in issuing the provisional measures. Now, political commentator Mohammed Khaled Sayed joined us earlier with his take on Nicaragua's case at a top UN court against Germany.
It's an extremely important move that has been made by Nicaragua. Very much in line with what our government has done with regards to taking Israel to the International Criminal Court, or no, to the International Court of Justice, rather. So I think it's, number one, it will result again in the narrative around the involvement of European countries in aiding and abetting genocide being put out there much better in the public domain. Perceptions will be changed, and I think it will most certainly have an impact on the German population. And the German population will then put pressure on their government as a result of it. So most certainly, it will yield results. As you saw with what happened when South Africa went to the International Court of Justice, it shaped more public opinion against the State of Israel. So it's most certainly going to have that effect. And I think we need to commend Nicaragua and actually encourage more and more countries to do the same as Nicaragua has done, following in South Africa's tone.
Israel continues with its all-out atrocities across the Palestinian territories. Regime forces have staged fresh raids in the West Bank, abducting at least 20 Palestinians in the past day. The troops stormed the Balata refugee camp east of Nablus, imposing a tight siege there. A number of Palestinians were abducted or injured during the attacks. In Qalqilia, IOF soldiers raided several homes and facilities and set up multiple checkpoints. Elsewhere in Tul Kerem, occupation forces stormed homes around the main hospital there, abducting at least 7 Palestinians. Another Palestinian was kidnapped in Ramallah following a raid on his home in the Al-Mari refugee camp. According to local sources, Israeli forces indiscriminately fired at vehicles and stores during their raid on the camp. Iran's southeastern province, Sistan and Balochistan, has witnessed a fresh terrorist attack. Several police officers have been killed in the attack that targeted 2 police vehicles in Sib and Suran County. Earlier, we're joined by our correspondent, Gisum Shahmedi, for details.
What we know so far about this terrorist attack is that a group of unknown gunmen attacked 2 police vehicles who were on a routine patrol, and they killed 5 police officers and injured 1. We do know that the Jaish al-Adla terrorist group has claimed responsibility, but according to Iranian security officials, the attack does not bear the hallmarks of this terrorist group, and it was too elaborate for them to be able to carry out this kind of a terrorist attack. And we also do know in that particular region, in Sistan and Balochistan, there are drug trafficking rings and rogue elements that might be responsible for this kind of attack, but search operations are still underway to find the perpetrators, Behrouz.
And that's it for this newscast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In May 1945, a group of experts prepared a base to detonate 100 tons of TNT. They were busy finding an appropriate criterion to measure a huge bomb in Alamogordo, New Mexico. The volume of the explosives should have been so large to simulate the main test. In the middle of all this, the differences of opinion between 2 groups of scientists over the secretive Manhattan Project grew larger. This group of scientists, who were supposed to change the mid-20th century's fate, could not reach an agreement on a certain issue. Most of them were of the opinion that after making an atomic bomb, the United States should put its power on display at night for Japanese envoys in order to make the Japanese emperor surrender by threatening him with the bomb. However, theoretical physicist Edward Teller insisted on testing the atomic bomb on a city to learn about its effects on its population.
The American people in there.
The only thing that could put an end to the differences was the speech by then US President Franklin Roosevelt for the scientist. It tipped the balance in favor of Teller.
Among other things, and at the climax, he said, "You scientists are blamed for the weapons to be used. But I tell you, that if you now won't work on weapons, the freedom of the world will be lost. Now, you know, I had the feeling that Roosevelt was talking to me. I was there when the letter was signed that awoke his interest in nuclear energy. I thought I knew he was talking about nuclear energy. Of the 2,000 scientists there, I felt he was talking to me.
Some people consider Edward Teller as a clear example of a mad scientist. Many critics believe that Stanley Kubrick was inspired by Edward Teller to create the notorious character Dr. Strangelove.
The report, my conclusion, was that this idea was not a practical deterrent for reasons which at this moment must be all too obvious.
Then you mean it is possible for them to have built such a thing?
Mr. President, the technology required is easily within the means of even the smallest nuclear power. It requires only the will to do so.
After the TNT explosion test, it was eventually decided that the first bomb should go off in Alamogordo, which is located 230 miles south of New Mexico in Los Alamos. The operation was codenamed Trinity. The codename comes from the belief in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in Christianity. They were planning to launch the largest massacre of human beings in the name of Jesus. This 21-ton bomb was 200 times stronger than the calibration test. The light was so intense that could immediately cause blindness. It was visible within the radius of 16 kilometers. It melted the sands in the desert and turned them into green crystals. The radioactive effects remained in the region for 50 years. Before the bomb was tested, two other bombs named Little Boy and Fat Man were secretly taken to Oceania to be prepared for an attack on two Japanese cities. It was 8:15 a.m. local time on August 6, 1945. The first bomb, Little Boy, was dropped on Hiroshima by a bomber named Enola Gay. For the bomber to have enough time to flee the explosion, they dropped the bomb via a parachute. To make the detonation stronger, the bomb was set to go off 576 meters above the ground. Those who saw Little Boy explode mid-air from a distance said they saw a new sun in the sky. After the blast, two-thirds of the buildings in Hiroshima, including steelmaking and industrial factories, were completely destroyed. The only thing that was left standing in the city was the Hiroshima Prefectural Industrial Promotion Hall. The explosion happened on top of the building's dome, and as it was within the central focus of the blast, it was not completely devastated. The moment the bomb went off, about 100,000 residents in Hiroshima died on the spot. While Japan was in shock and the Japanese people had almost realized that they were defeated, then U.S. President Harry Truman announced that this bomb was just a warning. 3 days later, another bomb was detonated in Nagasaki, which claimed the lives of 40,000 people in that city. The next day, Japan conceded defeat and surrendered to U.S. conditions to end the war. In the following years, more people succumbed to injuries sustained after the explosion due to radiation. Even though the U.S. honored its forces who were involved in the Manhattan Project and the agents in the carnage were awarded, the events pushed the public to rise up against nuclear weapons. The harms caused by the newly invented elements were not always sudden and tangible like atomic bombs. The start of nuclear war dated back to 50 years before when radioactive material was first discovered. In the spring of 1896, Marie Curie and her husband, Pierre Curie, discovered the amazing characteristics of some mineral stones, including uranium. They realized that the elements in the stones emit radiations that are not visible but pass through many barriers. The radiation was named gamma. After her husband's death, Marie Curie continued her research in 1910. It led to the discovery of radium as a new radioactive element.
Madame Curie!
The discovery made her the first woman to receive the Nobel Prize twice. But the award cost Marie Curie a lot. Many doctors say she was a victim of radioactive material, especially radium, during her experiments in the lab. The possibility was raised in the following years because back then nuclear scientists did not know anything about the harmful effects of nuclear material. It caused bigger catastrophe. The discovery of radium among natural radioactive elements with the half-life of about 1600 years left everyone in astonishment. The element's strange radiation added new color to advertisement in the West. Since the damage caused by the element and its radiation hadn't come to light yet, opportunistic traders sought to fulfill people's demands with these elements. They claimed that this dangerous material can help him live longer and healthier, so they introduced it to people's daily lives. They were used in the most sensitive cosmetic and hygienic products, including body lotions, lipsticks, toothpaste, and even water, bread, and chocolate. They claimed that radium as an ingredient in products is considered something positive. On the other hand, in 1917, the United States had just been involved in World War I. The army needed clocks whose hands were luminous at night in the dark. So factories across the U.S. took up the job and started producing clocks. To paint the tiny impact numbers on the clock's screen, they instructed female workers to press the tip of the brush with their lips in order to keep it tiny. They were told that working with radium paint was not hazardous. After a while, some of the workers were diagnosed with strange diseases. They would go to the dentist to pull their decayed teeth, but not only wouldn't they be cured, their teeth would get injured. Things gradually got worse. After dentists touched their jaws, they would get injured. Many of them had cancerous tumors in their bones and they would easily break. The first person who died was a 25-year-old woman named Amelia Maggia, nicknamed Molly. She succumbed to the disease in less than a year. The doctors didn't have an answer to her mysterious death. Gradually, as more and more female workers came down with illness, they pieced together the puzzle and found out that radium was the reason behind the deadly disease. Although, after 5 or 6 years in the mid-30s, advertising products that contained radioactive element and using them in products were altogether banned, their effects continued to last. After the atomic bombing in the World War, the Radium Girls and similar incidents like the Chernobyl disaster in Ukraine in 1986 and the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster in 2011 after the 8.9 strong earthquake, the international community rose up against nuclear energy. But the question is, why do countries, even Japan that was subject to the biggest atomic curse, not give up nuclear energy? Why does a country like Iran make so much effort and spend so much money to achieve such an apparently dangerous energy? West Asia is known for its wars. The wars were initially waged under different excuses, but they usually pursue the same goal, and that is oil. The United States' latest direct war in the region was launched in 2003. The US invaded Iraq under the pretext that the country possessed weapons of mass destruction, like biological and nuclear bombs. But after years of war and bloodshed, no weapons that were used as a pretext to invade the country were found. Even though no unconventional weapons were found in the country, it was rich in oil resources that was hugely extracted. After the invasion, oil was extracted and used to push US policies and economy forward. The US dealt with Iraq and raised accusations that are somehow similar to Israel's behavior vis-a-vis Iran.
This is a few. That Iran has another secret facility in Tehran, a secret atomic warehouse for storing massive amounts of equipment and material from Iran's secret nuclear weapons program. We exposed the site of Iran's secret atomic archive. It's right here, in the Shorabad district of Tehran. Today, I'm revealing the site of a second facility, Iran's secret atomic warehouse. It's right here, in the Turkuzabad district of Tehran, just 3 miles away.
Ever wake up? The Turkuzabad carpet washing center was Netanyahu's last trick for the media to get the international community on board his Iranophobia scheme for, quote, possessing nuclear weapons. But the Israeli regime did not stop there at the media campaign level. To date, it has assassinated top Iranian nuclear scientists. He's someone who doesn't want to realize that based on numerous inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and the religious views of the Iranian leader, it is not after nuclear weapons.
As of today, I can state that Iran is implementing its nuclear-related commitments. We have had access to all the sites and locations which we needed to visit.
So why does Israel keep insisting on the accusation and pursue such confrontational policies with Iran to stop the country from reaching nuclear technology? Is it possible that the objections are just excuses? Just like what happened in Iraq? How can the energy benefit Iran that the Israeli regime does everything it can to stop it from reaching the technology? It was exactly 6 years after the first and last nuclear bomb blast that a national lab in Idaho was lit up by only 4 200-watt light bulbs. Even though the EBR-1 project's goal was not to generate electricity, it corroborated theories concerning producing electricity from nuclear energy. The system, which was more complicated than making an atomic bomb, was later named nuclear reactor. The reactors could easily provide electricity for a city or more without constructing huge dams or consuming thousands of tons of charcoal and emitting pollutant gases. 70 years after the 4 famous light bulbs in Idaho were lit up, a little further away, Bill Gates, as the richest man on the planet and the owner of Microsoft, was investing on nuclear reactors that could work for 60 years after fueling just once. Today, reactors have considerably reduced consumption of oil condensates for producing energy. For example, the 1,000-megawatt reactor in Iran's Bushehr has saved 47 million barrels of oil that would otherwise be used for generating electricity in 7 years. In Europe, generating electricity is the foremost goal of using nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, but in Asia, there is a more burning issue, and that is water. West Asia is among the driest regions in the continent. It has only 1% of fresh water resources in the world. Many analysts believe that the next wars in the region will not be over oil. They say water is a serious concern in this part of the world. In this dry region, Israel has managed to export its agricultural products to all across the world, besides meeting 95% of its population's demands. The Israeli regime does not have underground water resources or many rivers. However, it has tipped environmental balance in its own favor by using nuclear technology to rein in nature. On the shores of the Red Sea, the saline water is desalinated for agriculture and drinking. As an example, Sorek, as the largest water treatment plant in the world, located 15 kilometers south of Tel Aviv, can purify 230 million cubic meters of water and tackle water shortage to a great extent. This amount of water is equal to the water Iran annually receives from the Karajan-Latian dams for drinking and agriculture in Tehran and Elbourz provinces, with a population of about 15 million people. Even though only 20% of the land occupied by the Israeli regime is arable, today it has become an agricultural hub.
This is the finished product, desalinated water. And according to the officials here at the plant, it's a more complete water than water that hasn't had the saline removed, because in the process of desalination, minerals are added back.
It seems the Israeli regime and Washington are seeking to stop Iran from accessing nuclear energy, not because they are worried it might make a nuclear bomb, but they are concerned that Iran might achieve the nuclear technology that can strengthen its independence and tackle millions of Iranians' needs. Water and energy are among the most vital necessities in agriculture and other industries, and even if a country like Iran does not need nuclear energy to fulfill its needs, it still cannot forego the energy. If the fruit produced by farmers goes bad before reaching the market, it will bring nothing but financial loss and physical exhaustion. Many kinds of fruit cannot resist against natural bacteria and fungus, as they quickly go bad. Today, the key to reach the market, especially the international one, is in the hand of irradiation. Thanks to nuclear technology, radiation technology has been around for 60 years and is used in the agriculture industry. Exposing fruits to the light emission of radiation for a short time can destroy the larvae and bacteria in fruits and increase its shelf life. Today, many agricultural products and even fruits like strawberry that have very short shelf life are exported to other countries. Exposing fruits to the gamma ray at entry points and quarantine centers of a country can stop the spread of insects and pests.
We have to look at the taste, the color, the granulometry, is there some foreign material, and also we look at the microbiology. Spices can be contaminated up to 1 million bacteria per gram. And with the irradiation, it can reduce by 99.9%. Other treatment will not offer that kind of reduction. Irradiation for us will not change the taste, the color, will not leave any residue, and also is really lowering the microbiological count.
When we piece together different problems like medical treatment, industrial experiments, and other issues a country can resolve by using the nuclear technology, we find out that there is a good reason behind Iran's political and economic battle to achieve the technology. Today, if a country wants to guarantee its economic, scientific, and technological future, it needs to step in this field.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful Hello everyone, brothers and sisters I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program The Ocean of Dua In this edition of the program we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss.
Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab, Qawwi ala khidmatika jawarihi واشدد على العزيمة جوانحي وهب لي الجد في خشيتك والدوام في الاتصال بخدمتك حتى أسرح إليك في ميادين السابقين وأسرع إليك في البارزين وأشتاق إلى قربك في المشتاقين وأدنو منك دنو المخلصين وأخافك مخافة الموقنين وأجتمع في جوارك مع المؤمنين
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing this excerpt of the Divine Kumail Supplication. حتى أسرح إليك في ميادين السابقين وأسرع إليك في البارزين So that I move easily towards you in the battlefields of the foremost and hurry to you among the prominent. وأشتاق إلى قربك في المشتاقين So that I desire fervently your proximity among the fervently desirous. وأدنو منك دنو المخلصين So that I move near to you with the nearness of the sincere وأخافك مخافة الموقنين So that I fear you with the fear of those who have conviction وأجتمع في جوارك مع المؤمنين so that I gather with the believers in your nearness. In this regard, regarding this excerpt of the Divine Command Supplications, dear listeners, in the previous episodes we mentioned that the best example of mu'min that Imam Ali alayhi salam is teaching us to ask from the Almighty Allah to be with on the day of hereafter, the believers, the true meaning of believers is the Ahlul Bayt. Now, the Ahlul Bayt, as introduced by the Holy Quran, by the different traditions of both Sunni and Shi'i scholars, they are the best creatures. Since human value lies in the balance of justice, faith, knowledge, and piety, based on the Quranic verses and traditions, the faith, knowledge, and piety of Ahlul Bayt is more than that of the other creatures having intellect, such as the angels, such as jinn and human beings even. Their faith, their knowledge of the past and future, these are at their perfect level. They are at their highest level. They are superior to all other creatures. Hence, their imamah and leadership is incumbent upon all. Without obeying them, people will be like blind, dead, and some animals even, although they may appear to be living and may claim to see, may have knowledge, and may seem to be human beings.
Oh my Lord, my Lord, my Lord, strengthen my limbs for your service and sustain the strength of my hands to preserve in your service and bestow upon me the eagerness to fear you and constantly serve you so that I may lead myself towards you in the field with the vanguards who are in the fore rank and be swift towards you amongst those who hasten towards you and urge eagerly to be near you and draw myself towards you like those who sincerely draw themselves towards you and to fear you like the fear of those who believe firmly in you and that I may join the congregation of the faithful congregated near you.
Thank you Allah that we're here feeling so good about all the things that we went through knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. Feeling the peace all around, seeing things we can never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
So the Ahlul Bayt are the best creatures. Common sense requires that a learned person must be followed by the unlearned, a scholar by the ignorant, a specialist by the non-specialist, a guided person by someone who is lost, and a prayer leader by a worshipper. So beyond doubt, if a man does not follow the Ahlul Bayt, he will not walk on their straight path. He will not benefit from their life-giving culture, which is the exegesis of the Quranic verses. If he does not obey their instructions, he will gain nothing. However, if he resorts to the Holy Quran and Ahlul Bayt, he will never go astray, nor will his life be wasted. It is reported by both Shi'i and Sunni scholars that the Holy Prophet ﷺ said, إِنِّي تَارِكٌ فِيكُمْ ثِقْلَيْنِ مَا إِن تَمَسَّكْتُمْ بِهِمَا لَن تَضِلُّوا أَبَدًا. Verily, I am leaving among you two valuable things. You will not go astray after me as long as you adhere to them. أَحَدُهُمَا أَعْظَمُ مِنَ الْآخَرِ كِتَابُ اللَّهِ. One is greater than the other. They are the Book of Allah, حَبْلٌ مَمْدُودٌ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ إِلَى الْأَرْضِ, which is a rope stretched from the heavens to the earth, وَعِتْرَتِي أَهْلُ الْبَيْتِ, and the other is my household. وَلَنْ يَفْتَرِقَ حَتَّى يَرِدَ عَلَيَّ الْحَوْلِ, they will never separate from one another until they come to me at the pond. فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ تُخَلِّفُونِي فِيهِمَا, so be careful how you deal with them after me. So, in view of the Quranic verses and narrations that we mentioned, the Ahlul Bayt are introduced as the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and the recognition of them means that we will obey them by our heart, we will obey them wholeheartedly, and this is how we get to know the Almighty Allah better. This is how we will be faster in the path of salvation. This is how we will pass from being only a simple wayfarer to mushtaqeen, that Imam Ali alayhi salam says, to be from among the barizeen, the prominent one, the fervently desirous ones. This is how we can be gathering with the believers in the nearness of the Almighty Allah. That's why Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَأَجْتَمِعَ فِي جِوَارِكَ مَعَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ. Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Dozens of civilians are killed in the latest Israeli attacks in Gaza, where the death toll has surpassed 33,000 and